Okay, everyone. So we've covered quite a lot of ground in the class so far, and you've certainly covered a lot of work on living in groups, wanting animals to live in groups. So today's lecture will be on collective animal behavior, specifically focusing actually on research that's done here in Konstanz. So you have a sense of how the work that you've been exposed to so far relates to some very contemporary science. And then in the next lecture, I'll talk about innovation and culture, and I'll move also into the final lecture to think a little bit about human evolution. So when we think of animal collectives, we think of properties like this, where you can see these schooling fish and flocking birds. And what's really remarkable about these patterns is that there's no individual leader orchestrating these properties. This is a so-called self-organized process. And so today's lecture will focus on what's actually going on within these types of animal groups, and also why do animals like this exhibit collective behavior. From an evolutionary perspective, this has been a bit of a conundrum because these organisms are unrelated to each other. So they're not getting the direct benefits of inclusive fitness, such as, you know, you'd get within ant colonies, for example. And so here in Konstanz, we've got a large number of people who study collective behavior. This is an expanding sort of focus of interest here at the university. And we look across scales of organization, literally from the simplest animal on our planet. This is called a placozoa. It's about a millimeter long. It's a collection of a few thousand cells. And this animal is the simplest animal on the planet. It's at the base of the metazoan tree. And as you'll see, if we image the motion of these cells, this is the density, and this is the orientation, the directions they're traveling, you can see local interactions giving rise to waves of information transfer across these groups, much like we see within bird flocks and fish schools. And so collective behavior was fundamental and essential for the evolution of life on our planet. And so we want to try to understand why and how do organisms exhibit collective behavior and collective dynamics? And of course, we ourselves are embedded within a collective, within our society. And that's what I'll move towards in the next future couple of lectures. And so this aspect of living together is something really fundamental to many, many organisms, of course, including ourselves. But the focus of attention on behavior, including in humans, has really focused on the individual in the absence of these social connections with others. It's really focused on how the individual brain works. But what happens if instead we change our focus a little bit and think about how brains communicate together or how social interactions can bring brains together? And of course, we are very complicated animals. We're capable of extremely sophisticated cognition. And yet, when you think about collective dynamics and collective behavior, you can sometimes see interesting properties. So watch this video here.
With his hat on in the elevator, first he makes a full turn to the rear, and Charlie closes the door. A moment later, we'll open the door, everybody's changed positions. Some good. Now, in a moment, on Charlie's signal, everybody turns forward. There it is. Notice, they take off their hats. And now, do you think we can reverse the procedure? Watch.
So this chap was completely unaware that he was being experimented upon. And you could see that he mimicked the behavior of those around him. He copied their behavior completely subconsciously. And you guys all do the same. You're not aware that you're doing it, but you're all doing the same. So even though we're very sophisticated and very complicated animals, when we're in social context, sometimes we behave in a remarkably simplistic way. And this leads to many of the properties that we see within our societies. So in the first part of the lecture, I'm going to discuss an sort of beautiful example of collective dynamics, which is insect mass migration, and try to understand how and why we have these dramatic patterns. And what I'm talking about here are organisms like this, locusts. So you've probably seen footage like this on television. These large plagues, there can be billions of insects within these swarms. They can extend over hundreds of square kilometers. These are some of the largest groups found in nature. And of course, they're devastating pests. And yet, prior to taking flight like that, these are wingless, flightless insects. This is time-lapse footage from our lab showing the locusts hatching out, and they'll dry out, and what you'll see is immediately they will start marching together. And so this stage, this juvenile stage, which are called hopper bands, these marching insects, are a critical stage because they inevitably precede these flying swarms. And even though people have studied locusts for a large number of years, we had no idea why these insects form swarms. And here you can see some further videos of these beautiful insects. And so why is this important? Well, this one species called the desert locust, which I study in Mauritania, can invade up to 1/8 of the Earth's land surface during plague years. But they're affecting poor people, such as subsistence farmers who can't afford insecticide. And so there's almost no research into how to stop these plagues from happening. The agrochemical companies have no interest because people can't afford to buy their products anyway. And yet they contribute massively to humanitarian crises. In fact, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations estimates that during plagues, they have the potential to impact the livelihood of 1 in 10 people on the planet through their impact on food shortage. It's astonishing that nobody is studying this organism given this type of impact on humanity. And what really sort of got me excited and sort of motivated to start studying this problem was reading in Science magazine in 2004 that even after 50 years, fighting locusts is more of an art than a science. And this is extremely embarrassing because certainly in terms of how the individual brain functions, the locust has been a model organism. It's actually one of the best studied organisms, perhaps second only to Drosophila. And so we know a lot about how the individual behaves, but of course, that doesn't allow us to understand how the collective behaves. You know, you could study an individual ant for your whole life, but it would never tell you anything about what happens when you put ants together and they form colonies and divide labor and so forth. So I want to address some fundamental questions today. Why do insects such as these locusts exhibit large-scale collective motion? And what are the biological processes that underlie this phenomenon? Because as I mentioned, we really have no idea or had no idea what was going on here. And so we took the locusts into the laboratory. We have them also here. And I developed software that could track the motion of all of the individuals simultaneously. So we can begin to use these computational approaches to track individuals and try to understand how and why they're moving together. And so we can take all of those data, those trajectories of the individuals, and we can reduce it down into the average alignment of these animals, or a so-called order parameter. And so this takes all of those data and asks, in which direction, either clockwise or counterclockwise, are the insects moving? If they're all moving clockwise, the value is close to 1. If they're all moving anti or counterclockwise, the value is close to -1. And we filmed the locusts for 8 hours, which is a typical day in the marching life of these insects. And so if we look on the left here, what you're seeing is a low density of insects in the arena. And it's a bit of a mess. The insects are behaving much like particles in a gas, where they're moving around and bumping into each other, but we're not seeing any collective motion. However, as we increase the density of the insects, you see here that the insects will almost all go counterclockwise and then suddenly flip to clockwise and then to counterclockwise again. So they'll choose a direction, a rotation, but then spontaneously, after many, many minutes, they'll suddenly change direction. However, if we increase density further still, they will choose randomly one direction, in this case it's clockwise, and move in that direction for the entire 8-hour experiment. So just by changing the density of these insects, we've caused them to undergo a transition which is a bit like a gas into a sort of driven, moving fluid. So we've captured the essence of the swarm formation that we see in nature. And it's not changing anything about how the individuals are behaving, it's simply just changing the density of these individuals within the arena. And it might be surprising to you, but this reminded us of magnets, of how magnets work. So if you look at a ferrous magnet, an iron magnet, I'm sure many of you have played with iron filings and to see the magnetic patterns. If you think about why is a magnet magnetic, well, it's because the little particles inside the magnet that you're seeing here tend to align with each other. That's the lowest energy state. So each magnetic particle is aligning with the local magnetic particles, who are aligning with their local magnetic particles, and so on and so on. And it's that long-range alignment that gives the collective property of magnetism. However, if you heat up a magnet to 770 degrees, known as the Curie point, you will suddenly lose the alignment. Why is that? Well, by heating it up, you're adding thermal noise. So the magnetic particles are beginning to jitter around. And so the individuals that are trying to align with each other, they're trying to align with individuals that are slightly misaligned, for example, and then you only have to go a short distance away and they're pointing in completely different directions. And so the noise spreads suddenly through the system and the magnet loses its collective property of magnetism. It suddenly becomes non-magnetic. Okay? And of course, if you cool it down again, that gets rid of this thermal noise and they can align up again and become magnetic again. And so we thought to ourselves, I wonder if we can think of and model locusts not as fixed magnetic particles in space, but as having as being mobile. So it's the same type of thinking, that they're aligning with their local neighbors. But the big difference between a magnet and, of course, a fish school or a bird flock or a locust swarm is that these latter groups have their own energy. They're mobile. They move. And that turns out to be critically important. And so the model itself is very, very simple. We simply assume that each individual tends to align, like the particles in a magnet, with their neighbors within a local radius. And we could estimate this radius experimentally and show that it's around 15 centimeters. So even though the swarms can extend hundreds of kilometers, the interactions among the insects is very, very local. And so we could simulate in a computer, just with these local interactions, the collective motion of the locusts, as we saw in our arena. And despite the simplicity of this model, we find that it behaved collectively very similarly to the real animals. Here you show this noisy state when there's very few particles. They're dominated by noise, and so there's no collective motion. And as we increase the density, in this case, they went counterclockwise for the whole simulation experiment. And we can now take each of our 8-hour experiments. So each point here represents one day's worth of work, filming for 8 hours. And we can then look at the total time they spent in the ordered phase. By the ordered phase, we mean moving collectively together. And you can see that as we increase the density of the insects, you increase steeply the proportion of time that they spend moving, marching together. And this is the real data, and this is the theory. And here you can see the total number of direction changes increasing and then decreasing as we increase the density, just as we find within the theory. So even though the theory is very, very simple, and of course it's not capturing all of the aspects of real insect behavior, nevertheless, it's able to explain to us some fundamental insights about why we see these collective patterns. And it shows that local interactions are sufficient to explain the long-range communication within the group. And in actual fact, these animal groups are very resilient to noise. They're even more resilient to noise than a magnetic system, because they're constantly changing neighbors. So unlike in a magnet, where the noise is always sent to the same neighbors, in these groups, because they're sort of fluid-like, individuals are changing neighborhoods, which means if you make a mistake about where to go, you're quickly corrected by others. You don't always just share the mistakes with the same individuals. And this is actually why, when you see bird flocks in fish schools, the groups are so stable, because the noise is being spread out so quickly from the system that it remains very, very robust. One way of sort of thinking about this is if you put a drop of milk into your coffee, how long do you think it takes for that milk to diffuse through the coffee? 10 minutes. I mean, I would have guessed something along those lines. It's actually around 2.5 to 3.5 days. But if you stir your coffee, it's a fraction of a second. So these animal groups are self-stirring, effectively, right? So you can imagine the noise, the errors being made, spreading like the milk in the stirred coffee. And it spreads so fast that it basically leaves the system, allowing them to be very, very stable and robust. So this explained to us how local interactions, local noisy interactions, are sufficient to explain these sudden formation of swarms. It also explained to us that all that's required is for the population size to increase, and spontaneously the locusts will start forming these massive swarms. But it didn't explain to us why they do so. And so that was our next challenge. And this was work I did with an undergraduate student in my lab, Sepede Bazazi. And I think this is one of the sort of exciting things about animal behavior in general, is that undergraduate students can make major, major breakthroughs. Right? There's so much that we don't know. The insight came from a problem that we were having in the lab, so to speak. So I'm not a morning person at all. But my postdoc, Jerome Buell, who was doing those locust experiments, hated it more than me. So I'd come in the morning, and I'd count the locusts, and I'd put them in those arenas and get the film going. And then at the end of the day, Jerome would do the cleanup. And he started getting really annoyed with me because I was putting in the wrong number of insects. I was meant to put in 110, and he'd get maybe 105 back out at the end of the day. And this was happening so consistently that I thought I was going mad. How come I'm not able to count? And so going back to the videos, I realized that in actual fact, I was putting the right number in, but the number was slowly declining throughout the day. And they couldn't be escaping. And so going back to the video, I noticed many, many examples of aggressive interactions where they'd come and they'd bite each other. And so we always thought of these as vegetarian insects. We didn't realize that they were actually cannibalizing each other. And so frequently we would find damage to the abdomen. And for a desert insect, this is really very, terrible thing to happen, because you're going to lose your hemolymph. And this poor locust here is completely doomed. And so to try to understand whether this cannibalism was important for driving the swarms, we conducted experiments where Sepede cut a little window in the belly of a locust and located the nerve that gives it sensation to its abdomen. And she could cut that nerve so this locust can no longer feel the biting of others from behind. But it's always important in experiments to have a control. And in this control, you also cut a little window, you also find the nerves, you even tickle the nerves with a paintbrush to show that you've stimulated it, but you don't cut it. And then you seal it back up. And what we found was that when we have swarms where we'd cut the nerves, this is shown in red over time here, this is the mean proportion of moving locusts, you can see that if you can sense the biting of those from behind, you'll start marching collectively. However, if you can't, the individuals actually become statistically as if they're not interacting at all. We'd remove their capacity to form swarms. So if you can't feel that biting from behind, you don't form collective motion. And so I went to Mauritania to try to understand this, to see whether this process was actually at work under natural conditions. It's a fascinating place to visit. I mean, there's almost zero tourism there. It's not exactly the safest place, but it's very, very interesting. And we did manage to find the locusts, thanks to our colleagues. And that's me filming them. And this is one of my colleagues with our camel that we used to carry the equipment. And in the background, you're seeing footprints in the sand, which if there hasn't been wind, you can actually track where the swarms have gone. It was quite a grumpy animal, but we were quite fond of it nevertheless. But it turns out that I'm not very good at field work, as it happens. And so we were there for about 2.5 months, and we packed, of course, lots of food into the car. I had plenty of money, so I didn't think that getting food would be a problem. But, of course, there's a locust plague. And because there's a locust plague, there's a famine. And so it doesn't matter how much money you have, people do not want to sell you what they have. And also, we're in the middle of nowhere, so you have to rely on passing tribespeople. And so what I did manage to get hold of were camel entrails. So these are the intestines of a camel. Our camel was not harmed. This is someone else's camel. And I'd been a vegetarian for 10 years prior to this trip. But this was all we had. You can see flies laying eggs and feeding on this. And so we hung it in a tree till it became a sort of jerky, tough jerky, and that was what we had to subsist on. And it actually didn't taste as bad as it looks, but because my body wasn't used to meat of any type, never mind this kind of meat, I became super sick, like really, really sick. And there's no medical care there. And then after I got better, after about a week, you can see how well prepared I was. This is like a 50-euro tent. This is my Mauritanian colleagues, and we're resourceful biologists. We also hang our clothes in this tree to dry them out. But what you're seeing behind me is a sandstorm coming towards our campsite. Couldn't believe my luck. and this was not a small sandstorm. I'm going to show you exactly this exact sandstorm from a satellite data from NASA. And this literally blew the locusts away. So I was there for 2.5 months. I still have the video in my office. I got 20 minutes worth of data. I keep that to remind me never to go back. So it was a disastrous trip. So we turned instead to the United States of America, where they have very helpful things like roads, to study a comparable system. And these are called Mormon crickets. So you can see, like the locusts, they are marching in unison. And they form these huge groups. You can see one grabbing another insect and dragging it along, giving an indication that they're also cannibalistic. Now, these are called Mormon crickets because when the Mormon settlers first went to the Great Salt Lake, things were going great. And then after a few years, there were these huge plagues of crickets that nearly wiped them out. They were going out with trying to use fire, water, whatever, to try to get rid of these insects, but they were eating all of their crops. And then God sent a flock of seagulls from the Great Salt Lake that ate these crickets and saved them. And so if you go to Salt Lake City and the Mormon Temple, you'll see a beautiful statue of these crickets and seagulls above them. And the seagull is still the state bird. And we also saw, by the way, seagulls coming in, flocks from the Great Salt Lake to feed on these insects. And so again, these so-called vegetarian insects we would find would eat roadkill, such as this poor jackrabbit. You can see them crawling in through the eye and in through the mouth, and they've eaten the ears off. The ears are normally almost the length of the body of these bunnies. So clearly, these are not the vegetarian insects that we once thought they were. And they would also happily eat each other. And so we conducted experiments where we could manipulate how much protein or how much carbohydrate is in the food. So it's artificial diets. Now you'd expect that insects who are vegetarian will go for carbohydrate, plant material. However, we also have a neutral diet, a diet, an artificial diet that's got no nutritional value whatsoever. It's a sort of McDonald's of insect diets. And you can see that they have no preference for carbohydrate over a diet that gives them no energy whatsoever. However, if we increase the protein in the diet to 21% or to 42%, you can see a strong preference. We also tested their preference for salt. Now, of course, I randomized it when I did these experiments, but the effect was so strong, I wanted to create a living histogram where we go from water to 2 molar salt concentration. And you can see them fighting over 0.25 molar. They taste, by the way, with their feet. So they're tasting it, and then they'll fight each other for it. And you can see this very strong preference for that particular concentration of salt, which of course turns out to be the concentration of salt in cricket blood. So these insects are finely tuned to a cannibalistic lifestyle. If you're in these environments, what's really limiting is water, protein, and salt. Massively limiting. And what better source of these essential nutrients than a perfectly packaged insect of your own species? And so when the populations grow, they run out of these rare but essential resources, and they have to turn to cannibalism. And the turning to cannibalism means that the insects start moving away from others because they're trying to eat you, but you have to move towards others to try to eat them. The outcome is swarm behavior. So it looks cooperative. It looks like they're all marching together to help each other out in some way. But it's not. It's actually a forced march. Individuals attack those ahead and try to prevent themselves from being attacked from behind. Stop, and you risk being cannibalized. So we discovered that what looked cooperative was actually driven by a completely different evolutionary pressure. And so this gave us considerable insights into how and why these organisms behave the way they do. And here in Constance, we're developing very, very sophisticated techniques. By we, I mean Jake Graving, a PhD student in my group, whereby we can now, this is sped up video, but we can now track the motion of the individuals, we can keep their identities with barcodes, and we can even reconstruct their body posture and their antennal movements automatically. And this is zoomed in on one insect within a large arena. So some very exciting future prospects. And another issue is we have no idea what happens when the swarms are flying. So here in Constance, again, we're building a large 15 by 15 by 8 meter flight arena to try to understand what's going on. But cannibalism isn't, of course, the reason that other animal collectives form aggregations or form groups. In other cases, what's really critical is collective information transfer. And so if you look at this group being attacked by a predator, you can see why in the 1950s and 60s, it was believed there must be telepathy or thought transference among the individuals to coordinate their behavior. But what we now know, and here's a simulation that I've developed, is that these local rules, much like we see in the locusts, can explain what's going on. And it's that each individual, if they turn, they cause others to turn, who cause others to turn, that creates these waves of response that we see in these systems. So collective information transfer is an extremely important aspect of these types of groups. So you can see the wave of turning away from this predator, and if we pause and rotate around, you can see this vacuole. And so I've become really interested in this idea that it's the social connectivity that brings minds together. And can this lead to something such as collective cognition? Something that goes beyond the typical way we think about intelligence. Is there such a thing as collective intelligence within these types of groups? But it's very difficult because of this tight interplay of interactions. It's very difficult. You can't just use thought experiments. We actually have to turn to computational approaches, such as the simulation I showed you and the tracking, to try to get inside the head of this individual to understand how and why she makes the decisions she does. And so we don't need to care much about the details of these equations. All I want to suggest to you is that we can simulate these properties, much as we did for the locusts. We can capture the essence of their social interactions using a computer to create virtual groups that we can study. And this has been a very important process for us. And so what do we mean by this? Well, individuals exist at certain positions in space, which is denoted by C, the centroid of individual I and J at time t, and they have velocities. And again, you don't need to care about what these equations are. All you need to think is that when individuals become close, we can simulate the fact that they try to avoid collisions. For birds in flight, it can even be fatal to collide. If individuals move too far away from the group, of course, you can lose the benefits of group living, and so we can simulate a tendency for them to be attracted to each other, the opposite of repulsion, and also to align their directions of travel, as we discussed before with the locusts. So simple local rules, close range repulsion, and a longer range attraction and alignment. And that is sufficient. These simple local rules is sufficient to explain the properties that we see in nature. And this means it's very robust. You can take an individual from a group and the group doesn't lose its capacity to function. It's so-called self-organized. And importantly, these interactions are relatively local. And yet, like the locusts, even though individuals are only interacting locally, this scales up to large-scale collective dynamics, such as these patterns that I showed you previously. Here, of course, there was one extra rule, which is move away from the predator. And what we've found within these types of models is something very interesting, which is that, again, we can sort of think of an analogy to physical systems. If we think of physics, if we think of the collective behavior of the physical world all around us, there are a multitude of ways that molecules can combine and interact. Yet look at the collective properties around us. We see solids, liquids, and gases. So despite all of that diversity, it doesn't actually matter so much in terms of what the properties are at the collective level. Whether it's glass or metal or wood, these are all in the solid state, the solid collective state. Of course, there are differences between them. But broadly speaking, we have this complexity at the local interaction level that becomes simplicity at the collective level. And so much like we have liquid, solid, and gases in our physical world, we predict that there are three fundamental states of motion within these types of animal groups. The swarm-like state, which is a bit like a mosquito swarm. This parallel moving state, which is very similar to fish schools, bird flocks, or locust swarms. And finally, a milling state, where the individuals perpetually rotate around an empty core. But there's nothing in the equations of motion that said go in a circle. This is a so-called emergent outcome. And when I saw that, I couldn't believe it. I didn't realize that this was going to happen because we cannot predict how this multitude of interactions will scale up to collective properties, which is exactly why we need to do this type of modeling. There's another interesting property that we discovered within these groups. We discovered that, like in the physical world, if you heat up a liquid, it suddenly turns into a gas. If you cool a liquid to freezing point, it suddenly freezes across the whole system. So there are these very sudden transitions in collective state. We find the same in our system, and it was driven by speed. If the individuals slow down, they become dense and disordered like a solid. As they speed up, so what we're doing here in red, what I'm doing here in red, is I'm speeding up the individuals and then running the model for a very long time, and then speeding them up a little bit more and running the model for a very long time. And what you see is as I speed it up, we follow the red line to the right, we go into this milling, rotating state. And then finally, if they move fast enough, we go into this parallel group state. But using exactly the same model, now if I slow them down slightly and run the model for a very long time, then slow them down slightly and run the model for a very long time, which you're seeing in the green line, you see that they do not follow the same path. They stay in this state and then finally transition back into the swarm state. So you can see that we have two different collective behaviors for exactly the same individual interaction rule. And the previous history of the group structure determines which one we will see, even though no individual has any knowledge of that history or indeed of what the group structure is. So what does that tell us? It tells us two fundamental things. One is that there's collective memory in the system, a memory encoded not in the individual brains, but in the system itself. And the other is that natural selection can't just create one set of local interactions and you'll always get the same collective behaviors coming out. What collective behavior you see might depend on the previous history of the collective behaviors that have existed. It's quite a complex way of thinking, but this is actually also analogous to what you find in physical systems. If you cool water down to form ice, you can actually heat it up a little bit more than the freezing point, and it will still stay ice. You have to heat it beyond the point at which it froze. So this is called hysteresis, or collective memory in the system. And so here, for example, there's a bottle of water that's close to freezing point. You can see it's liquid. You can see the bubble of air in there. But tap it on the car here, and small imperfections lead to crystallization of ice, and ice spreads through the whole system. So this water existed both in the liquid phase and the solid phase at the same time. Depending on the previous history, you'll see different properties. And it turns out that this ability for systems to suddenly exhibit collective transitions is very, very important for how they process information. And so we turned to using, and we still do, we have tens of thousands of small schooling fish in our labs here. We turn to small schooling fish because they're small, they're convenient to work with, and they exhibit the rich dynamical properties that we're interested in. And so this is a relatively large tank. I've sped time up here, and you can see the fish exhibiting this sort of schooling state and then suddenly transitioning into a milling state. And we develop software that tracks the motion of all of the individuals within the groups, more sophisticated than the locus software. And this allows us to quantify these behaviors. And remember the predictions of the model. Now the model, of course, is not capturing all of the details, as the locus model was not capturing all of the details. But we know that those details don't tend to matter when we look at the collective properties, much as the details of the molecular interactions don't matter when we deal with collective properties. And so indeed, exactly as we predicted, in over 100 hours of filming, we've only ever seen these three fundamental states of matter. And as the model predicted, it's the speed that matters. If they move slowly, they become sort of dense like a solid. As they speed up, they enter this polarized or milling state. And by the way, they don't know which state they're in. We've tried to determine whether they know that. They have no idea. So why is this important? Well, it turns out this is how they process information. So we wanted to set our fish a computational challenge. In this case, they have to find the darkest region in the environment. Well, they don't have to. They want to. And they want to do that because that's where they feel safe. And you can see this if you go down near the Inzo Hotel. If you look at the dappled light in the water there, you'll see the fish conducting this behavior in the natural environment. So what they're doing is they're trying to find the dark regions because that's where they're cryptic from predators. But because we can't see them in the dark, what you're seeing below is exactly the same experiment, but we've cut out the visible light with a filter and we've filmed them in infrared light. And so you're seeing the same experiment at the top and at the bottom. But this allows us to track the motion of the individuals. And of course, because we are projecting this environment onto the base of the tank, we can put that back in to understand both how the individuals interact with each other and also how they interact with a complex time-varying environment where the solution is always changing. So they constantly have to find a new solution. And we found the first experimental evidence that indeed, as group size increases, individuals become much better able to solve this problem. So it's a form of collective intelligence. There's a huge benefit to being in a large group here because you can find much better environments. And of course, this could relate not just to light, this could relate to chemicals in the water that are cues for food. It could relate to thermal gradients. The point is that the individuals are not capable of doing it. You can see here, they're very bad at doing it. But if they're in a group, they become excellent. And so we thought to ourselves that what's maybe happening is each individual makes a sort of noisy estimate of where to go. And by being in a group, you can sort of pool these noisy estimates. This is the so-called wisdom of crowds effect. And so we asked ourselves from our data, over what range do individuals detect the environment? Over what range do they detect each other? And how does that lead to this collective intelligence? And of course, doing experiments is always fun because you get many surprises. And what we found is, as the blue line shows, the social vector, which is how important social interactions are, is incredibly important. But we found no evidence, as shown in the red dotted line, that individuals were able to detect the environmental gradient at any scale for any group size. Which led to a conundrum. If the individuals are not utilizing the local light gradient, how on earth is the group able to do so? The individuals simply don't do it. And what natural selection has found is a very simple but elegant solution. The individuals don't need to integrate in space and time to work out the direction of the gradient. They simply speed up in light regions that they do not like, and they slow down in dark regions that they do like. Now that means, on average, yes, you'll spend slightly more time in the dark, but as you saw from the data, it was very, very ineffective. But now, if we start thinking about the social interactions among the individuals, they facilitate an awareness of the environment that does not exist at the level of the individuals, and the groups can now suddenly climb the gradient. There's two ways of thinking about this. One is that if you imagine my hands to be two fish moving forwards, and there's an elastic band connecting them, representing the social interactions. If they move forwards together, and then this one finds a dark region and slows down, this one doesn't know about that, it keeps going fast, that elastic band is going to get stretched and stretched and start exerting a centrifugal force towards the dark region. So that effect is important, but also, like cars on a highway, because time to collision is the important thing, when you're moving slowly, you become dense. And so individuals are more attracted to you because you're in this dense region. And so those are key factors. But another way of thinking about it relates directly to what I told you before about the relationship between speed and these sudden transitions, like the transition between the liquid water and ice. What's happening is if part of the group moves into a favorable region and slows down, they will solidify. But the part that's still moving in the unfavorable environment moves fast and remains in the liquid phase. So within the group, you have this sudden transition in collective state. And that is actually what's causing the processing, the collective information processing. So natural selection has tuned the behaviors. I mean, we couldn't understand this type of relationship without understanding the, sort of the physics of these types of groups, how these local interactions scale to collective properties. You know, this people haven't thought in this way before, especially not biologists. You know, but here, the group is sort of undergoing this sudden transition in collective state within the group, and that allows it to process information. And this is now, so our golden shiner fish have now inspired shiner bots, a new generation of tiny robots, because this algorithm exists in the collective, not at the individual level. So we can put it into tiny robots. I mean, these robots are, you know, maybe a centimeter long. In future, the idea is to make microscopic robots that can literally go inside the body and utilize collective intelligence to find, for example, gradients that lead to tumors and so forth. But we're quite far away from that at the moment. Okay, so I talked about the interactions among the individuals, and I used this sort of simplifying assumption. I even used an elastic band analogy. But of course, these organisms are not using forces such as we see in the physical world. This is how we've tended to model these systems in the past, because we've been inspired by physical systems. But now we have the technology to track the motion of the individuals, to get their body posture, to calculate where the eyes are, and then to reconstruct computationally the pathways of photons onto the retina. So we can reconstruct the visual fields of each individual to see the world from their perspective. So here you can see a close-up. So this is a real animal group, a real fish school. And so you can see here the left visual field shown in red, the right visual field shown in blue for this randomly chosen individual here. And you can immediately see that this is a very complex scene, a complex visual environment. And so we wanted to understand a hallmark of collective behavior, and what really describes collective behavior is the change of a behavioral state of an individual or individuals changes the behavioral state of those around them. Later on, when we come to humans, we'll think about opinions, how we change each other's opinions. But when we think of these simple animals, we can think of a change of behavior such as this alarm response, then spreading across the group. And this is adaptive because it allows individuals to respond to a perceived threat without even detecting it themselves. And these waves, this is slow motion, these waves propagate very fast across the group. And so we conducted 205 experiments where we could initiate the startle in any individual within the group. And the startle itself is driven by only two cells, two giant cells, called Meuthner cells. It's a reflex reaction. But if we look at the size of these cascades, and this is a little bit difficult to see because it's a log-log axis, but what this basically means is most of the time, the number of events is close to zero, which means no one is responding. However, sometimes you get this very large effect. And this is much like news stories or Twitter. You can tweet something, and most of the time, it won't get retweeted much, if at all. But sometimes, tweets can go viral, or news stories can go viral. And again, we'll come back to that later. Was that predetermined? Does it matter what the story is? Does it matter who sent it? Does it matter what the network structure is? All of these are aspects that are being explored. Let's consider animal groups today. So we need to establish a mapping between the visual input and motor control. Because all organisms, as I mentioned in the early lectures, have to deal with this complexity of the world around us. And we have to reduce this complexity down, and this is what our brains have evolved to do, to a relatively low-dimensional behavioral output. In this case, do I startle or do I not? That's the decision that each individual in the group has to make. And it has to make it based upon this complex, time-varying scene that it's witnessing. And we know very little about this. But recently, using this computational visual field reconstruction and body posture mapping, and some new techniques in machine learning, which we don't have to go into here at all, we've been able to work out which visual features each individual pays attention to. So we can then understand what they're paying attention to in their visual field and how that translates to behavior. And what this allows us to do is for the first time to reconstruct the pathways of communication within these real groups. This is not a simulation, this is a real fish school. And these connections here represent probabilities, the probability that I will change behavioral state if you do, and vice versa. And so this is, we sort of see this as revealing the hidden network of interaction within groups. Because if you want to understand how the individual brain works, you can go in and look at the circuits that give rise to individual behavior. But in animal groups, or in animal collectives, or human collectives even, social interactions often have no physical form. Only in online systems do they. And so we're revealing this hidden network of communication that gives rise to collective behavior. And the network itself is complex. Even though it turns out the visual features they use are simple, some individuals can influence others more strongly. For example, you may strongly influence me, but me not you. This again is a characteristic thing, a characteristic property of biological systems that physicists have never had to think about. So it introduces new complexity into these networks. And that's what these arrows represent, is the direction of social influence. And so here you're seeing for the first time a video of a real fish school where we've been able to reconstruct the social network that gives rise to the collective behaviors. And you can see it's quite beautiful as well. But what we want to understand is the relationship between social influence and network structure. We want to understand this both in animal systems and later on in human systems. So, how do people typically think? They typically think that the most socially influential individuals are those with many connections to others. This in the network literature is called a high degree. It just means you've got many, many friends, many connections. And whose neighbors have a low cliquishness. In the network literature, this is called a low clustering coefficient. Well, why is this assumed? This is assumed because it's intuitive, and because people have previously thought that behavior spreads much like a disease spreads, just much faster. Right? So if I have a disease, I don't believe I do, but if I have a transmissible disease and you guys are not resistant to it, the more of you I spend time with, the more of you I'm in close proximity to, the greater is the probability that I will infect individuals in the group. So that's why many connections to others makes intuitive sense. Now, what about the low cliquishness? Well, imagine these two in the front here don't want to speak to the riffraff, the rest of you. They only interact together. And if I interact with them, with this clique, I could infect them, but they're not going to infect you because they're not connected to you. And so for diseases to spread, you actually, you know, you need a low cliquishness, right? You need these long-range connections, and that can cause epidemic outbreaks. So this is very intuitive, and this is how people thought behavior worked. But there's no experimental evidence for this yet. So we wanted to ask, is this actually true in the real system? Is this actually the case? And it turns out, no. It turns out in real biological systems, the most socially influential individuals, the so-called super spreaders of behavior, not of disease, of behavior, are those with a low degree and whose neighbors have a high clustering coefficient, exactly the opposite of the intuition, exactly the opposite of what people have assumed in the past. But importantly, we can ask why this is the case. It has huge consequences on our understanding of how information spreads. But we can ask, why is this the case? And it's the case because social contagion is a so-called complex contagion, whereas disease is a simple contagion. Let me explain that for a moment. So again, if I return to the disease analogy, the longer I am in contact with you, probabilistically, the higher is the chance I will infect you. Right? That makes sense. But now let's say I have a political opinion, say regarding Donald Trump. I might try to persuade you of the merits of Donald Trump all day, but you may not be convinced. Okay, Donald Trump's too polarizing, but think of any sort of opinion. It's not the longer I spend with you, the higher is the probability I will convince you. I just might not be able to convince you. Right? And in actual fact, animals, including humans, are often not convinced by a single individual giving their opinion. So I might influence you a little bit, but you don't change your opinion. But you're inside, you're a little bit closer to a threshold of changing opinion. So I influence you directly, but then I influence you, and I change your opinion, and you influence you and change your opinion, and then you two talk later, and you change opinion based upon what she said. But also, I influenced you directly and indirectly through this loop. So these loops of communication turn out to be super important. And what humans do is they seek reinforcement from multiple individuals that are so-called uncorrelated. Right? If you've got a friendship group, it's very likely that the information they have is the same. Right? So collective intelligence is eroded if you just use information, because you could take information from any one of them. It's the same as taking it from all of them. The information is the same. So what humans do is they seek reinforcement from individuals that seem to be outside these social groups. You know, you've got different friendship networks. You've got maybe sports groups. You've got people you meet in class. You weigh this up differently. Okay? So one way I think about this is I used to be at Princeton University, and I was in New York City with my friends, and they were trying to persuade me to buy an album. And I was kind of convinced, but not fully. Then I got back on the train on New Jersey Transit to go back to Princeton, and the couple in front of me on the train were talking positively about the same album, and I bought it. Right? So it's that reinforcement from an independent source that turns out to be important. And all animals, fish, birds, humans, seem to obey this general rule. And using this new understanding of how information flows through networks, through social networks, and how it differs from disease flowing through networks, which has been studied, by the way, for almost 100 years, we can now suddenly predict what's going to happen before it happens. Now, suddenly, I talked to you about whether a Twitter story is going to go viral or not. Well, we couldn't predict before whether an individual changing behavior would cause a huge change to the group or be completely ignored. But now we can. It all comes down to being able to visualize and analyze that network. Of course, this is very difficult to do with humans. So we're still talking about a very simple system here. But we are beginning to be able to do this on human social networks like Twitter and Facebook and so on, which are simplified versions of real human-human interactions. There's also interesting aspects of spatial position and influence. So individuals are not just visually identifying others within the group and communicating with them, they're also seeing what's going on outside the group. They're bringing information in, and they do so really from the edges of the group. So lots of the classical sort of thinking about animal groups has been that being on the edge is dangerous and being in the middle is safe. But if you look here, the individuals on the edge have a heck of a lot of information about what's going on. Those inside know nothing. If a predator suddenly comes through here, these individuals might be most at risk. And in actual fact, what we find is that both the external visual field, so the access to external information, and how effectively social influence spreads are both maximized at the edge of the group. So what you read in many behavioral ecology textbooks, that the middle is safe, the edge is dangerous, may not be true, because the previous theory has not considered any dynamics. We also find that being at the back is great for getting external visual information. Individuals almost have 360 degrees field of view, but it's terrible for social information. And so the best place to be is actually going to be the front of the group. Okay, so you want to be at the front edge, front or side edges of the group is our prediction. And you do not want to be at the back. That's going to be the most dangerous place. And that's where predators should target, if this theory is correct. Or this is, of course, built on real data. So we tested this using a new type of sonar imaging that allows us to image real predators attacking fish schools and tracking the motion of the individuals within these groups, showed several interesting things. One of the interesting things is if these arrows here represent the prey. They represent the directions that the prey are moving. You can see they're moving this way, which means the predator is attacking the back of the group, which is what we predicted. And the colors represent the density of the animals. And so what you see is the vacuole that I showed you in the simulation earlier, forming around the predator. The predator's in the middle there. So you're seeing from the predator's perspective, as it attacks, the prey flows out and around and reforms behind it. So predators attack groups from behind. So it's really the front and side edges that are the safest. But predators have a problem. Because remember, these waves of information transfer are propagating very fast through the group. And they, in fact, propagate faster through the group than the individuals can move, than the predators can move. So the predators now face a problem when they're dealing with groups, that the groups are so capable of information transfer about that predator that they can move away from it without even detecting it directly. So what do the predators do? Well, they also use collective behavior. They form hunting groups. If you look at where other predators are, they're directly ahead or directly behind. And it turns out to be exactly at the distance at which the schools will reform. So they prevent the schools. There can be up to 6 individuals in a line. So they slice through the group. They stop the group from reforming behind the predator. And by slicing through the group, that means the groups get smaller. Now, if the groups get smaller, yes, the information still flows very fast in that group, but it flows over a smaller distance because the group is smaller. And if you can get the group smaller and smaller still, you break down the collective intelligence. You break down the capacity for these waves of information to flow. And if we actually look at the risk, the per individual risk, how close they get to the mouth of the predator, you can see that for large groups, the predators are in great trouble. The groups can outmaneuver them, and the predators can't catch anyone. But if they manage to slice and slice and slice the prey schools into these small groups, so collective information transfer can no longer operate, suddenly the predators have the advantage, and their capacity to catch the prey increases substantially. So collective information transfer is critical to understand the evolution of predator and prey interactions. And importantly, it's not just the prey that use collective behavior, but the predators have evolved to use it too. To counteract the collective behavior of the prey, they've evolved collective behavior of their own. Now, as a little aside, I also want to just introduce, this is not going to be examined or anything like that, but this is just a bit of fun, something we're developing here in Konstanz, which I'm pretty excited about. Because it's been very difficult for us to really work out who is influencing whom within these groups, because it's hard to establish causality. You know, if I'm influencing you, but you're also influencing me, and at the same time you're being influenced and influencing someone else who's influencing someone else, it becomes super hard to really work out, establish what's going on. So these studies that I've showed you with these simple animal groups have taken us years because it's so difficult to establish these network of relationships. So we had this idea when I moved here a few years ago. What if we created virtual reality environments for animals? And what if these virtual reality environments were so realistic and so immersive that effectively we're creating holograms, so holographic animals, in the same space. So it'd be like having another student in this class that all of us think is a student, even though it's only an illusion. Right? That's what we're trying to get to. And it's really early days. Most of this is not published. Now, it sounds kind of science fiction-y, but it's actually based on a very old illusion, and an illusion that I know is going to fool you. Because even though I tell you it's an illusion, your brain cannot get around the illusion. Let me show you what I mean. Okay, I just want to explain to you just a sec before. These three objects on the table, the Rubik's Cube, the tape, and the shoe, they are not three-dimensional. I'm going to tell you that now. but your brain will see them as three-dimensional. Your brain can't but see them as three-dimensional, right? So if we zoom in on the Rubik's Cube, we can look in at great detail. It's not 3D, but your brain thinks it is, right? And the illusion will soon be broken. It never was 3D. But even when the person puts it back in slightly the wrong, you know, different location, you can see your brain instantly will flip it back into a 3D object. Nothing you can do about it. The same with this tape. This is not 3D. You've now even seen the illusion. You know how this works. But your brain is still fooled. It's such a strong illusion. It's called an anamorphic illusion. And so this is how we are going to create photorealistic, three-dimensional animals that real animals will interact with. Now, this person, of course, you can see that it's quite resilient to exactly where you view it from. But if you view it from a different angle completely, the illusion breaks. But this person would have to sort of cut out lots of different pieces of paper in different angles and change it every time you move substantially. But in a computer, we can do this 100 times per second. So we can now use this illusion. And so there's a real zebrafish at the top and a virtual zebrafish below. We can use this illusion, but use a computer to update that visual scene using a video game engine. So we're effectively in a video game, but the world is always using this illusion. So it's always going to be this sort of holographic illusion for the animal, right? So we can put anything into that. We're not putting Rubik's Cubes in or pieces of tape, but we can put other animals in, and they can interact with the real animal. And so just to give you a sort of simplistic example, this is how it looks. So the fish are in a bowl. We're projecting onto the base of the bowl. We're running this video game engine. And this is the virtual scene we're creating. It's not very interesting. It just has a single pillar in the middle. But this pillar doesn't really exist. And this looks distorted because, remember, it's always projected. So from the eyes of the zebrafish, this is sped up. From the eyes of the zebrafish, this is that anamorphic illusion. This is that Rubik's Cube recalculated as it moves. So it's always in 3D from the perspective of the fish. And if you look at the movement of the animals, they avoid the pillar, even though it's not there. And so we can go further than that, and we can create a virtual zebrafish. So a photorealistic virtual zebrafish. And what you're seeing in B is how a real zebrafish swims. So we track that, we get the motion of the real zebrafish, and we reconstruct this virtual zebrafish. Moves like a real fish, but it's also going to be embedded in the same volume as the real animal. And so you can simply see which one is the virtual fish here, because it's moving in this artificially circular trajectory, so we can see who it is. But you know, importantly, these animals, this real fish, is interacting with it and following it. It thinks it's a real individual in full 3D space, even though it's only an illusion. So we call this a holographic illusion. So the individual really believes this individual to be another of its kind in this environment. Much as you are fooled, the fish are also fooled. They can't help it, but believe this to actually be floating in the tank with them, even though it's not. But because this illusion only works from the perspective of one individual, because if you have a second individual there, the world is just going to look distorted. We can only have one individual in each of these tanks. We can have as many virtual individuals as we want, of course. But we also want real individuals to interact with each other in a holographic world. And so to do that, we can network these systems. So the individual in this tank is interacting with a holographic representation of the real individual in this tank, the real individual in this tank, and so on. And of course, we can play around with this. We can have virtual individuals in there. And so we call this sort of colloquially the matrix. Right, the individuals are not actually in the same physical space as each other. Each is interacting with a hologram of the other, and yet you can see them moving and interacting. And if we compare this with how real animals move and interact, they behave in the same way. And you can see they're doing this fully in 3D. So they really believe they're to be in this volume. And here you can see four individuals interacting within this environment. And we now have six of these environments. We're the only group in the world to have this, by the way. And this is allowing us now to really be able to control how social information is conveyed to individuals, to look at individual differences and so on. So let's leave it there for today. And then in the next lecture, I want to talk firstly about collective decision making in animal groups, but then to move to how these properties work in human systems.